William Henry. Welcome, subscribers. Today we have a very special guest. His name is Stephen Mailer. He's the author of Land of Osiris and the new book, From Darkness into Light. Stephen's an Egyptologist and a field archaeologist who has spent more than a decade in the tutelage of one of the great masters of the indigenous traditions concerning ancient Egypt, Dr. Abdel Hakim Hawan. Hakim, as he prefers to be referred to, has long been an advocate of much older dates for the Sphinx, the Giza pyramids, and other temples and structures throughout Egypt. Hakim refers to the ancient civilization as Kemet, not Egypt. A relatively unknown and non-traditional oral tradition tells the story of ancient Kemet, and Stephen Mailer is carrying this work forward. Stephen, thanks so much for joining us today.
Well, great to talk to you again, William, as always.
Yeah. As you know, I just returned from Egypt, and I had posted an article about Abu Ghraib, which I certainly want to reflect on with you here in a moment. But before we do that, Stephen, I'd like to just kind of refresh the memory of some of our listeners about some of the work that you're doing. One of the themes from your book, From Light into Darkness, is that religion, as we know it today, is actually a de-evolution from an original, more pristine or highly evolved spiritual consciousness that existed thousands and thousands of years ago. I thought it would be nice if we started just to kind of touch base on that concept and give us an idea of what your thoughts are on that matter.
Well, great. Yes, the basis of the indigenous traditions that have been brought forth by Hakim had been a concept of cycles, that we have not moved in a linear evolution in a straight line, but that everything in nature moves in cycles. And it's certainly been this truth for human consciousness and human history. So what we're talking about is In From Light into Darkness, my current book. I actually discuss in more detail the last two cycles, going back over 10,000 years ago into an age that we call Aten, or the wiser, to the current cycle that we're in now, Amen, or darkness. So distinctly in my book, I make a distinction between spirituality and religion, that spirituality is something that's been part of the human condition for time immemorial, but that religion is more a modern invention, and it's more a modern byproduct of this current age, so that we say that religion is actually based on the tenets of spirituality, but it's much more a controlling situation that it has become today, particularly in its fundamentalist sense. So we're talking about cycles, and we're talking about the last two cycles in particular, and how religion has evolved, perhaps in around the last 5,000 to 8,000 years in the current cycle of darkness.
One of the key ideas that you proposed that caught my imagination was that in what you describe as the age of Aten, that the people had full consciousness. What does this mean, and what happened to these people and to this fuller consciousness?
That's an excellent question. What happened to them is that we are them. Aten actually translates as the wiser. It actually means the fullest stage of consciousness, the sun at its fullest expression, like late afternoon. So in that time period, which is well over 10,000 years ago, we're speculating, because we're not in that consciousness today, that not only did we not have a written language, but we did not have a spoken language, that people communicated telepathically. And the concept that we use is what has degenerated into the field of Egyptology as this idea of gods and goddesses. The term is Neter. And it actually doesn't mean deity as we define deity today, but an aspect of consciousness, a divine principle, or a sense. So Hakim teaches us that we are innately born with 360 senses, so that we're only using 5 today, the rest are dormant. So we're talking about a time where we were in full circular consciousness, 360 degrees, everyone would be considered to be in a degree of enlightenment, highest state of consciousness, and that what is the classic theme in all of mythology and all the stories of indigenous people around the world is of a fall from a golden age. Well, this age of Aten was the golden age. And this fall, I speculate, has happened within the last 5,000 years to 8,000 years. We've gone into this lower stage of consciousness. We no longer can communicate telepathically. We no longer have the understanding of symbols and myths that we once did. And so we had to invent symbols for writing. We had to use writing and text to explain things which people could understand from symbols, from intuitive understanding. And so the idea is now that we're coming to the end of this current age and that we are coming to a new dawn. And this is why the teachings are coming out now. We will return to that higher state of consciousness. And this is why these teachings are coming out now from indigenous people all around the world.
Yeah, one of the most interesting things you note is that the science that is today closest to an understanding of of this kind of spirituality, this fuller consciousness, is quantum and theoretical physics. Talk about this concept for a moment.
Yes, in fact, I rely heavily on the work of a man named Dr. Fred Allen Wolf, who has been interviewed by Hans Struber, and I think Whitley too. He wrote a very interesting book called The Spiritual Universe. He actually has been to Egypt, I believe, in 1995, and he went with a group of Mickey Scully, and Hakim was his guide. So he actually mentions some of Hakim's teachings in his book. What quantum physics is clearly showing us is that everything is interrelated to everything else. There is no separation. That's one of the key things of Hakim's teachings. Nothing is separate from anything else. And therefore, everything relates to everything else. Every cause is an effect. Every effect is a cause. And quantum physics is showing us this continual dance and interplay of vibrations of subatomic particles is really what the universe is made of. There's no vacuum in space. Everything has got energy flows, consciousness, as the ancient mystics called it. And this really leads to an understanding of the ancient teachings. So it's like the new modern science is now moving from physics to metaphysics and bringing back the spirituality of old. Everything's interrelated, everything's interconnected, and everything on the micro level is reflected on the macro level, as above, so below.
And Stephen, in addition to Dr. Fred Allen Wolf, you have been a student of Hakim. Tell us about Hakim, how you've come to know him and what his teaching has meant to you.
Yes, and an exciting thing for people to understand is that Hakim will be coming to the United States. I'm now making an announcement to everyone. He's going to be visiting me in Colorado. He's going to be doing some events the end of June in Baltimore, and people can contact me to get information about that. But I will be doing presentations with him here in Boulder, Colorado, so it's very exciting.
Is there a website, Stephen, or a phone number they can call to get more information?
I can get that information to you. We could post it if you'd like. Would you want me to?
We'll be happy to. Yes, thank you.
Yes, I can give the specific references on that. How I first met him, how I first became aware that tradition still existed was through my work, and particularly getting into the metaphysical tradition of ancient Egypt. I came across a book by Murray Hope, a very interesting Wiccan priestess who was an alternative Egyptologist, who talked about connecting with an oral tradition, an indigenous tradition that still existed in Egypt. I had confirmations from others that this tradition still could exist, so when I finally did get to Egypt in 1992, lo and behold, Abdel Hakim was the tour guide for the group I was involved with. We became friends. So the first day I was in Egypt, I met the man who has become my teacher. And it's now gone on 14 years that we've been working together. And the man just turned 80. He has spent his whole life, well over 70 years, gathering the oral traditions from the elders of his country. When he was just a young boy of 6, he would be talking with very, very old people in Egypt. And he gathered this information. He also gathered it from the academic standpoint. And then he went on, studied the Western tradition, got degrees in Egyptology and archaeology, and was able to present now a very, very unique perspective with the Eastern and Western tradition and combining with the indigenous tradition. So it's been a whole lifelong search for him, gathering these traditions, and he's had other students besides myself, but I've worked with him the hardest, it looks like now, and to bring these teachings out, that there was a previous civilization, as you mentioned, called Kemet or Kempt. Actually, it's Chem, if you pronounce it correctly, and the Arabic term, one of the Arabic terms for Egypt, Al-Chem, is where the word alchemy comes from. As you mentioned in your article, Misr is another word. It's also where the Hebrew word Mizraim comes from, which is another term for Egypt. And so it's Kemet. It's actually, that's what this black land, a rich, dark alluvial soil that the Nile deposits where the civilization grew. And Kemet, we can't even put boundaries on it. Each time I work with him, it seems to go, what was ancient Kemet over 10,000 years ago was from Central Africa, almost to the south of Africa, certainly Western Africa, Northern Africa, through the Middle East, what would today be Iraq, Jordan, Syria, Israel, was all part of Kemet, even to parts of Central Asia is considered part. In fact, Sumer was not considered a distinct civilization. The last time I was in Egypt with our king, he gave me the term Sa-mer-ra, which is where Sumer comes from. And it was just a section of Kemet. So all of these, it's called the mother civilization to this indigenous tradition. And it goes back perhaps hundreds of thousands of years, which will lead us in to the subject matter you really want to discuss at one particular site tonight.
Yes, absolutely. But just before we do that, one thing I want to talk about, Stephen, is that you note that the concept of fresh water, known in ancient Kemetic as God, is the key to the lost cultural context we're trying to understand. So before we talk about Abu Ghraib,
sure,
let's just bring that piece into the mix.
Very
quickly,
very key piece, William, because the major aspects that Hakim concentrated with me when we really started to work in 1997 in the field together was the ancient knowledge of sound and water and the interplay of both and how it was such a major factor to the civilization. In fact, Asgat is just one term. What we find is that we don't know exactly how many terms that they had for water, but there were many. And there were many understandings. And the idea of even working with water. Now, there's a term I introduce as Asgat, and it actually did become to mean water, but originally Hakim says it actually referred to an occupation, to a priesthood, to the one who works with water. Now, he's saying that that was an incredible occupation because the fact of using water, utilizing water, digging for water, using water for fuel, for food, all the different aspects of water was used, was many, many different occupations. So the original definition of Asgat was the one who works with water. Later, it became just water itself. And water was key. Key not only for crops, for fuel, for life, but actually, we believe, was a source of energy. Like the Great Pyramid, for example, which was a machine. Perneter means the house of nature, house of energy. Christopher Dunn has written the best source on that it was a power plant. But it produced so many different types of energy. It had so many functions that we'll probably spend the rest of our lives and maybe the generations after us exactly decoding how many different functions the Great Pyramid had. But one specific one was to take water, catalytically convert it to oxygen, hydrogen, use the hydrogen gas for fuel, oxygen, of course, we know could be used for so many different things. So water was a source of fuel for the Great Pyramid and many of the pyramids. And in our research, we have found tunnels, the water chambers, we found water erosion. The evidence is mounting so strongly in a physical sense, not just an intuitive sense, but in a physical sense, that pretty soon people are not going to be able to deny this any longer. I mean, we have actually found damage inside the Great Pyramid, which disproves completely any idea that it was a tomb or even a temple, that it was a machine. But water was a tremendous key, tremendous understanding. And the person in ancient Kemet was considered wise who knew the secrets of water.
Yeah, and the reason I want to talk about that, Stephen, is because when we get to our conversation about Abu Ghraib, I've proposed, based on research done by Ted St. Rain and others, along with Zachariah Sitchin, that the Anunnaki also had direct knowledge of water, specifically water mining techniques where they were able, through perhaps a harmonic process or other, to bring gold out of water. But before we bring that in, I want to talk about one other thing, Stephen. As you probably know, I like to use word plays and puns, and one that I think is most interesting involves that word chem. It's interesting that the letters C and K are interchangeable. For instance, chem, K-H-E-M, is the root of chemistry, which is spelled with a C-H.
Mm-hmm.
And so if
but
chem...
But it has the hard K in Greek, you're right. Yes, hard K.
So yeah. If chem is spelled C-H-E-M or even C-H-Y-M, it now, in my view, rings of chem or chyme, C-Y-M, as in cymatics or kymatics, the study of wave phenomena,
mm-hmm.
water, waves.
Mm-hmm.
Aren't we seeing a kind of interesting pun develop here that chem and chyme or cymatics, the science most profoundly associated with Hans Jenny,
Hans Jenny, we believe, like Victor Schauberger and Johann Grander and other incredible scientists in the 20th century, and Nikola Tesla, just rediscovered what the ancients already knew. But yes, I always find that interesting, those word plays, because Hakim likes to play with things like that too. He often does roots of words and breaks it down. And to him, it's always the sound that's important. So it would be the k sound, the chem, kymatics. He probably would have pronounced it kymatics, not cymatics.
Yeah, but, kymatics, absolutely. They're interchangeable.
Well, what I think also, there's another gentleman who should come into this mix. His name's Stan Tennant, who did some very interesting research that way, using geometric forms, using light onto certain geometric forms, actually gives, flashing on the wall, the root letters, the root symbols, like from Greek, from Hebrew, and probably, I'm sure, from Phoenician too. that you get the form, you get light, you get sound, and that's how symbols evolve. And sound affecting on a membrane, definitely, you put sand, you do certain different vowel sounds, different tones, and the sand forms into different geometric shapes. Some people even see it forming into some of these, again, mother letters or root letters. So there's, you know, and it's a very, I always bring this out, I bring it out in my book. One of the ancient definitions in Kabbalah, when you're talking about the Tetragrammaton, the Yod-Heh-Vod-Heh, which becomes Yahweh in English, Jehovah in the Christian faith, actually there is a Kabbalistic term that describes the Tetragrammaton as the sound that rushes through the universe. So that a lot of people think when there was creation, but, you know, we don't believe there was a beginning, but to create in physical form evolved sound and form. And that's what gives physicality its essence. And so water, sound, geometry, all interconnected in these understandings, and all something I again say we're just rediscovering today what the ancients already knew. And we were those ancients. That's a key thing that, in fact, I was just listening to an interview the other night on Coast to Coast, and a gentleman was talking about the Great Pyramid, and it's always this literal understanding instead of realizing that a lot of these things were symbolic, not to be understood or taken literally, but the key understanding, the use of sound, the use of water, the use of form, is basically what the ancient civilization was all about.
As you're talking, Stephen, I'm recalling the Cherokee Indian creation that says that formless thought beings rode a sound wave from the Pleiades star cluster through a hole in space in East Tennessee and created the Cherokee.
I'm convinced that, you know, the whole of existence, you can say universes, all levels, all dimensions, is total infrasound. You know, we only have our auditory ability to hear what we call visible sound, the sound spectrum that we can hear. But what's amazing about the Great Pyramid, which has been proved, is that it's still producing infrasound. I have told people that this whole civilization of ancient Kemet was totally bathed in this sound, infrasound, for health, for healing, for growing food, for all the things you've talked about, for raising consciousness, so that I don't think there's any such thing as total silence. I think that everything that exists, the vibrations of subatomic particles, is producing infrasound through everything that is. And sound is a key understanding. In fact, I'm going to be working with a sound healer, and I'm also going to be bringing Hakim's oldest daughter, Sherazad, here to the United States at the end of June and July. And she features techniques of using ancient Egyptian healing by using great toning and sound qualities. And it's amazing. Once we understand that we are constantly bathed in infrasound, and that infrasound is what actually maintains health when it's in its proper vibrational quality.
So let's now shift gears then a little bit, Stephen, and talk about Abu Ghraib and the concepts and how it relates to not just sound but also water. As I understand it, Hakim has described this Abu Ghraib site as the oldest ceremonial center on the planet.
At least
and
one.
He also, pardon me?
At least one of them, yes.
At least one of them. And yes. It's a site where the ancients connected with the divine energies known as netters. So talk with us for a moment and introduce us a little bit more to this Abu Ghraib site from Hakim's perspective and also from your perspective.
It's beautiful that you got to go there. And I really appreciated some of the things that you said about it when you were interviewed on the subject, that you felt mixed feelings. I definitely have the same. It's not an active archaeological site. Tourist groups are usually not able to go there. There's no guide. There's no ticket vendors, nothing like that. It's an off-the-wall site. It's between Giza and Saqqara, near the site of Abu Sir. They're actually connected, Abu Sir and Abu. And actually, the pronunciation is supposed to be Abu Ghraib, but we say Abu Ghraib. It means the father of crow's nest. And to make a little correction, Abu Ghraib, the prison in Iraq, actually means the father of the small crow. So it's not actually the same word. Abu Ghraib means the father of crow's nest. Abu Ghraib, where the prison is in Iraq, actually meant the father of the small crow. But it's similarly related. I don't know why they call that site that. It has to do something with the ancient understanding. But we know why our site, Abu Ghraib, was called that way by the Arabs. because there was a mound there where there was an obelisk on it, 15 feet solid piece of granite, an obelisk, and different ceremonial sites. There was a pyramid there, and there was a temple there. But what we see now there at the site is just ruins, and yet there is a platform made out of solid alabaster that shows the four directions in a sign called the Hotep, which Egyptologists have defined as meaning peace or satisfied, but also means a table of offerings. And that's exactly what that Hotep is at Abu Ghraib. In all four directions, four of them facing the four directions, was a temple of offerings. Now, the key thing is offering to who? To a king? No. To the gods? Yes. But in what meaning is that? Now, as you said, Hakim would say that the site dates hundreds of thousands of years. For tens of thousands of years, people have been going there as a pilgrimage. That's why you felt such incredible energy there, and why you were so right on in the things you said about it. And this is what usually first thing people experience when we go there is just relax, take a deep breath, and feel it. Because if you're sensitive to any degree, you can feel that thousands and thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of people have been coming there for thousands and thousands of years as a ceremonial site. Why? Because something happened there. Yes, what happened there? Well, they put it in the terms that in one time period, the Netters appeared there in person. So what does that mean? Are we talking about extraterrestrials? Perhaps, because Hakim's tradition does embrace that idea that we are starseeds, that this is not our home planet. We have come from different directions in the sky. So was there actually a landing at Abu Ghraib, perhaps 200,000 years ago, in the time frame where Sitchin would talk about the Anunnaki, 250, 300,000 years ago? Yes, yes. That's what the tradition says. Something happened there that is venerated and celebrated. The gods, the Netters, appeared in person. Now, the fact is that people continue to go there for thousands and thousands of years to, as we say, commune with the Netters, to commune with the divine aspects of ourselves that may have been manifested in physical form from advanced extraterrestrial beings. Now, I'm totally, you know, I embrace the whole aspect of that. It could be spiritual, it could be symbolic, and it could be literal. And I know you look at it in a literal sense. There's quite possible that there was some things going on there. We do discuss the Anunnaki. We do think that there's validity in Sitchin's ideas, except that we don't think that they were the only ones, that there was not just only one group. And I don't embrace the idea that we were created as a slave race for the Anunnaki. That, you know, there may be some possibility to that, but when you go through the richness of the tradition, I mean, we were planted here, we were seeded here to be a divine creature, not to be a seed, not to be a slave race. And so all our different ancestral beings, you can say from the Pleiades, you could say from Sirius, from Orion, from Aldebaran, from Alcyone, from so many different places. So it's never specifically said who landed there, but it is an understanding that ancestors, that's why people continue to go there, never for a king and never for, in a religious sense, to a god, but actually to celebrate our ancestry coming from the stars. So there is definitely that feeling, Abu Ghraib, of interdimensional, extraterrestrial, you know, however you want to put it, but that it was a sacred, sacred place. And I found things, I mean, I found potsherds there that go through so many different styles that show thousands and thousands of years of occupation and visitation there by just the dynastic people alone. You see potsherds that you could date definitely from a New Kingdom period, from Middle Kingdom period. Then you see pieces of pots that are not thrown, that weren't on a potter's wheel. So that goes back thousands of years before that. So, I mean, you know, there's no way, I believe, to accurately date the site. I mean, they try to date it to, as you mentioned in your article, which was excellent, to the 5th dynasty, because they see evidence that the 5th dynasty, the people came in there and did some work. But, you know, underneath the sand, some of the objects we could talk about, the artifacts that are there, are way, way beyond 10,000 years old.
Yeah, I mean, Stephen, it appears as a virtual virgin archaeological site. It's like there's no work being done there. It is utterly peaceful when you're there. Why do you suppose it hasn't received the recognition that it deserves or indeed actually warrants?
Well, you know, again, it has to deal with the mindset of the Egyptologists themselves. I mean, work was done there, but it was done there perhaps 100 years ago to maybe 70 years ago. Like you said, you didn't see any evidence of any recent work. I mean, they went in there. They found things that they thought dated to this certain particular king of the 5th dynasty, and that's how they leave it. They don't see whatever else comes in. It may be anomalous, like we can talk about the so-called basins. They'll just stick it into their paradigm, figure out, well, you know, okay, they were used for animal sacrifice. Something that can figure into, fits in, once they've set their paradigm. And it's very interesting how, you know, I talk always over and over again, how the science of Egyptology has evolved, how it began with some very interesting speculations when it started 200 years ago, 150 years ago, and then certain assumptions became prevalent at towards the end of the 19th century, early 20th century, and those assumptions now have become, you know, carved in stone as fact, you know, that there was nothing there before the old kingdom, the pre-dynastic was nothing, and so that's where it dates. So, William, I can take you to dozens of sites in Egypt where the archaeology has only scratched the surface, only in its infancy. If they would just dig a couple of feet here, dig a couple of hundred feet here, we would find the evidence. I know where they should be digging in Egypt, you know, but we need millions and millions of dollars of budget. You need the approval of the Supreme Council of Antiquities and Dr. Zaghi Wath. It has to fit in their paradigms before they let you dig. But I know where to go that we can find this evidence, because the only thing that we do agree with Dr. Zaghi Wath about is that we've only uncovered less than 20% that's under the sand in Egypt. So what you see with Abu Ghraib on the surface, there's more under the ground. There's more still buried. There's more that's there. There's more that's been taken away that is in private collections around the world or in museum basements, things that were found there. That if you and I could have been there 150 years ago, 200 years ago, in its pristine state before a lot of this tomb robbing, the black market antiquity salesmanship has been going on, we would be amazed at what we could see and what could be excavated and what could be found. There have been so many things found that are not known to even the majority of Egyptologists because they've never been published, these finds. But, you know, it's great because the people in the village, the villages are the people who work on these excavations, and they talk, and they spend, and it becomes part of the oral tradition. So I always hear a lot of things, this has been found here, this has been found there. You know, the question is, can we relocate that object? Can we take a picture of it? Can we document it? Or does it just become hearsay? Does it just become part of the oral tradition? This was found there, and it's no longer available, you know. But the things that are, as you saw at Abu Ghraib, are amazing enough in itself to seriously question the accepted paradigms of what that site's all about.
Yeah, without a doubt. And as I proposed in the article, based on conversations with Ted St. Rain, who's traveled the world with Sitchin and been to some of these other sites, he sees it as perhaps a water processing facility, a place that the Anunnaki might have been involved with in terms of mining gold out of water, either through some harmonic process or some other means. And I know you've mentioned that Hakim, as well as yourself, probably wouldn't go along with that view.
Well, you know, William, I have been thinking it. I have been thinking it, and it is a possibility. It is something we can't reject out of hand. It's not part of the oral tradition that mm-hmm. was what was done there. However, in my current book, From Light into Darkness, we redefine the people that were called the Hyksos, who many Egyptologists, alternative researchers, think were the Hebrews and were involved in the Exodus. We reject that. But however, Hakim has given us a complete different understanding of who those people were. And Hyksos, of course, is a Greek word. The ancient term was Heka'u Kaswert. And Heka'u means working with sound, the sacred sound. So Hakim has said these Hyksos were really, really early geologists. And they use sound to extract metals. So I don't reject that out of hand. I know Sitchin, we've talked about, Sitchin has talked about Tiahuanaco up in the Bolivian Andes as perhaps showing evidences of metal work there too. So, I would go back to Abu Ghraib and look at what Ted's talking about and look at it with open eyes, and I will be going back there next year with Hakim, and maybe we'll discuss that, and maybe we'll come back with something on that.
It is a distinct possibility.
The one thing is for certain, all tradition, that it was considered a very sacred site for many, many, many thousands of years before dynastic Egypt.
And so, Stephen, let's talk about how we begin to recreate this. I know you're working on some of these ideas and exploring them. How close are we really, do you think, to being able to duplicate some of this sound technology?
Wow, that's a great question. And only limited demonstrations, but I think we're moving faster. I'm actually going to be working here with one of the well-known sound healers in this Boulder area, Jonathan Goldman, very soon. And there's a gentleman, Tom Kenyon, Don Campbell. Many people are working with sound. And so I think we're moving in that direction. But the reason why a lot of people always say, well, if we had enough funding, could we duplicate some of this technology? Could we duplicate the Great Pyramid? And the fact, and I think you yourself are becoming to understand this more and more as you go back to Egypt. It's not just a question of the nuts and bolts, the technology. It's a question of consciousness. So we're not ever going to be able to totally duplicate what they did until we can get into that higher state of consciousness, which may be a long way off for us. But however, I am confident still in my lifetime, which, I don't know how much is left, but within a certain number of years, we're going to start to see some of the things demonstrated. We're going to start to see that sound can be used to levitate stone, large blocks of stone, not just small pebbles as being used demonstrated today, but large amounts of stone, that sound could be used to shape and cut stone, igneous rock, like granite, alabaster, diorite, basalt. And so I think we're close, William. I think we're moving closer as we start to move from consciousness, which is what is predicted from this new dawn, the awakening we're going through, even up to the Mayan calendar date. We can talk about that. I think we'll start to see more and more of this being demonstrated. But for the full capability of it, no. People ask us, can we build a scale model of the Great Pyramid using Chris Dunn's ideas and Hakim's teachings? No, because I don't think they ever did build a scale model. I think the consciousness was there, that they built it as it is. And it all was, there's no blueprints, there's no diagrams. It was all realized in the mind and then constructed in its impeccable form. So we're not there yet, but I think we're moving there. And I think as we move into higher consciousness, more and more of these things will be demonstrated so that we will see that the technology, we describe the Great Pyramid as a spiritual machine, and you can't leave out the spiritual. We have to be in that state of consciousness before we'll fully remember that we were those people. And this is why I always like to say, and this is why I had a problem with the person that George Norrie just recently was interviewing, talking about Enoch built the Great Pyramid, and Enoch, strict literal interpretation of the Old Testament, Enoch was a messenger, meaning an angel, and so the gentleman was saying he couldn't possibly believe that we humans could build the Great Pyramid. That's selling us short. That's denying our heritage, because that's what I clearly say when I talk about the Great Pyramid. Aliens and Atlanteans did not build the Great Pyramid. However, we must discuss those subjects, Atlantis and alien and extraterrestrial ideas, because they are real and because they are important to understand. But it's selling us short to say that we were not ever in the state of consciousness that we could do that, because we were, and that's what tradition tells us. That's not to say that we do not have alien lineage. We do not have extraterrestrial genes which have jump-started our so-called evolution. Yes, and we can discuss the subject of Atlantis, because I know it's a big subject for you, but I prefer to use the term global maritime culture. You actually used a term. I forgot the term you used. I used the term mythologem, that Atlantis is a key mythological thing that's gone down for many, many, many centuries to describe a previous state of high awareness. But it was not centered in just one place in the world. My opinion, over 10,000 years ago, what we would call Atlantis was the global maritime culture, which existed worldwide. And we're seeing evidence of that every day. There's a new archaeological site, new artifacts are discovered, which showing advanced civilization was all around the planet over 10,000 years ago. So we discuss Atlantis, yes. But to say that someone else came into Egypt, and I know you use that phrase, a shadow of Atlantis, or the remnant of Atlantis. That's where we get into a disagreement, because we're saying that, yes, there could have been an island continent off the Straits of Gibraltar, where Plato was supposedly said it was, no doubt, but it was not any more advanced than it was already going on in the heart of Africa at the time, advanced civilization. And they may have been related. They may have been connected. They may have shared and traded together. And the cataclysm that came that caused the mythologem of the sinking of the advanced civilization, people did scatter all around the world and did definitely come into Africa, but they didn't bring in the idea of building pyramids of advanced civilization. It was already there. That's the only way. That's the point where we differ, that's all.
Mm-hmm. And that's what I find so interesting, is that when you follow the trail of Plato's story, it clearly came from Egypt. And then, as I also discussed in the article, you're led to this group of texts from the Temple of Edfu known as the Building Text that appear to suggest that at one time, formless beings came from the stars, created an island called the Island of the Egg that was destroyed.
Matter of interpretation. We don't interpret the text exactly saying that. I actually spent a lot of time with Hakim at the Temple of Horus at Edfu, looking at the building texts and going over them with them. Mm-hmm. And we believe they've been mistranslated. We believe what it's actually talking about is the time when the Netters walked the earth, the time when the people were one with the Netters. We believe that to say that instead of saying an actual literal interpretation of physical beings coming down, that it's talking about the fact that people were in that highest state of consciousness where the Netters within would combine with the Netters without, so that people were in that state when the Netters walked the earth, meaning that we were the Netters, we were in the highest state of consciousness. And what actually we think that the texts that Edfu are talking about is that what was ancient Kemet over 10,000 years ago was a series of islands. As I mentioned in the first book, The Land of Osiris, we think there was a great, great river which was called the Nil by a German researcher named Blankenhorn, that it was a huge river, 100 miles across, thousands of miles long. Evidence of satellite photos show exactly where it was, which is all desert today. And that there was a series of islands. This great river had many tributaries, and there was a series of islands. And as the Kemetians came into consciousness, they went from island to island, building temples, building pyramids. And that's the idea that it seems like it's saying that there was a cataclysm and that people escaped a cataclysm and came. When we analyze the text that Edfu, the building text, really was not a description of a cataclysm. It was a description of the Netters walking the earth, and the people moving from island to island, place to place, and all of a sudden this great had the ability to build these great structures in stone because the consciousness was there. Now, again, that is not to deny that there has been visitation, because that certainly is an active part of the oral tradition. So I believe it's not an either-or, you know, thing. It could be both.
I think that's very interesting, Stephen. I recently interviewed a person named John Lash who is been delving into the Gnostic text, and in one he found a reference to Sophia as a consciousness that enveloped the entire planet, and it's his proposition that Sophia originated from the center of our Milky Way galaxy, and almost describing it as like an impulse of energy or vibration frequency that embodied itself in the planet. And it seems to me to have a strong correlation with what you're describing with the Netter. What are your thoughts?
Very interesting, because Barbara Hand Clow has written about this, talking about what she calls the photon belt. And there's other people who have been talking about that, too. Coming from Alcyon, which is the central star of the Pleiades, which is the center, the galactic center. And she's saying that this happens at the end of the cycles, and this is what's leading to the Mayans were aware of this, the Mayans talked about this, and that's what's leading up to the end of the so-called phase, the Mayan calendar in 2012, that we are being bombarded with this energy coming from galactic center. I have no problem with that. I see that that's the, you know, again, I'm looking at things now and trying to look at it as a really holistic thing, not getting into, well, it's either this or it's either that, you know, it's like,
right.
The word paradox, I used it many times in my current book. I've had a whole series of discussions with some people just recently where everything comes out being a paradox, where something can be true and not true at the same time, where it's not black and white, it's shades of gray. So
it's quantum, right? Yeah.
Yes, yes. So I think that whole idea of the photon belt, energy coming from galactic center, that seems to be that ancient texts talk about this. The ancient peoples talk about it. The Mayans talked about it. The Kemetians did talk about it. So I'm agree with that. I think we are moving to the end of this cycle.
Where are Hakim's thoughts in this regard as concerns the present cycle that we're in right now and the run-up to 2012?
Well, he's adamant about it, and he never has wavered. One of the things I talk about to certain people is the consistency of some of the things he's been sharing with me now for going on 14 years. And one of their greatest consistencies is that this cycle is coming to an end. This cycle of Amun, of the darkness, of the hidden, which has been characterized by rampant patriarchy, technology out of control, wars, violence, sexism, racism, all of these things that, and fundamentalist religion that has characterized our last 5,000 plus years. But that he is adamant that nothing can change the fact that the cycle is ending, the dawn is coming. It's the Cheta, the scarab beetle is the symbol of our work. It's the symbol of dawn, the first stage of consciousness. He is adamant. Every time I see him, and sometimes I come, and I'm pretty depressed. I'm looking at world events, the war in Iraq, this and that, maybe possible war in Iran. But Hakim, as always, he says we are growing every day. Nothing can stop it. It is inevitable. Nothing, no one, no being, nothing can change this cycle from coming to an end. And it is rapid. He doesn't put a time frame on it. Like the last group I was with in November, someone asked him, Mr. Hakim, what do you think about this date 2012 in the Mayan calendar? And he just laughed and said, it means nothing to me, because the date, the calendar means nothing to him. B.C., A.D., well, Christ, after Christ, he says it has absolutely nothing, no meaning in his tradition. However, if he's saying that, are we coming to the end of a cycle now within the next few years? Absolutely. And he says every year it will be geometric in that more people are waking up, consciousness is growing. He pointed to me years ago, the years 2004, 2005, 2006 were going to be very pivotal years for growth of consciousness. And it certainly is what seems to be happening. And we always use the expression, it's darkest before the dawn. Some people can really get into pessimism now to see what the world events are, the division in our country by itself, I mean the nonsense that's going on with our leadership, which you write about very eloquently in the books, The Cloak of Illuminati and others. He says that this is just trivial, that this is not going to be the way things are going to be, that nothing can change this fact, that it's darkest before the dawn, but that people are waking up. So these cycles are the way it's always been and the way it always will be, and he is absolutely convinced that it's coming to an end within these next few years.
Wow. Well, Stephen, unfortunately, our time has come to an end for today as well. We're very much hoping that when Hakim comes to America, we'll be able to have the two of you back on for Dreamland for
more detailed conversation. Absolutely. And I'm talking about, if I could, I will send this information that can be posted. That I am still leading another tour to Egypt in November through bodymindspiritjourneys.com, and I can get that information to be posted.
Oh, absolutely. And we'll look very much forward to talking with you again this summer, Stephen. Thanks so much for joining us this afternoon. Okay.
If there's any question you could ask, Hakim.
Great. Well, this is going to be outstanding. Everybody, you're in for an amazing treat, including myself. I've never met Hakim, but I feel like we're kind of on the same spiritual wavelength. So this is going to be outstanding. So once again, Stephen, thank you so much.
Thank you, William. It's always a pleasure.